Welcome back to the Big Show Podcast here on Podomatic.com. I'm your host, Robert Henson. Thanks for coming back and tuning in once again for another podcast from the Big Show. We've been down for a while, and so coming back, we gave you author Clive Barker and a recent interview we had with him. And to keep our star-studded Big Shows coming your way, this is going to be a two-parter, starting off with actor Richard Kiel. Richard Kiel, best known as the character Jaws in two James Bond movies, The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, but he's also well-known for his parts he played in Force 10 from Navarone, in Clint Eastwood's Pale Rider, and of course, in the original The Longest Yard. Richard joined us to talk about a book he's written called Cassius Clay, Kentucky Lion. It's about the history of the original Cassius Clay, whom Muhammad Ali was named after. So please welcome to the Big Show Podcast today, actor and author Richard Kiel. Published author is now just another thing to add to your resume. We were talking some about some of the movies that you've been in, and you know, even though you're best noted for your roles in James Bond, which was great, which, by the way, I love the fact that in Moonraker you got the girl too.
Oh, well, thank you.
That was just great.
And she turned me around, and I went over on the good side of good.
Yes, you turned out to be the nice guy.
Yeah.
But you know, also I think back to when I was really young and I watched movies like Force 10 from Navarone, or my particular favorite, The Longest Yard.
Oh, yeah, that was a big breakthrough movie for me.
I mean, you have really kind of done the gambit when it's come to different styles of roles, too, because you don't always just play the muscle, so to speak.
That's true. Yeah, I was so fine with Ryan O'Neill. I was, a big, very rich, wealthy gangster with no class, Pale Rider Western.
Oh, yeah.
I was the killer on the train. Kill people with a gun.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because you bring up Pale Rider, too, and that was something I was just watching the other night. And you know, that's another one where, once again, in the role, you're the big guy, but there's a scene with you and Clint Eastwood, and not the fight scene by the river, by the rock.
Yeah.
But the later scene when he starts blowing everything up and you grab the gun and you once again help the hero to achieve his goal. How do those things come into movies when you're such a big guy and you're such
I think it comes from your own personal charisma. You know, I'm not a great actor, but you know, there's a likable quality that comes through. It's kind of like with John Wayne, you know, and so, you know, the directors start thinking, you know, maybe there's another way we can use this guy that would be more interesting.
Well, it is, and honestly, you may say you're not the greatest actor, but when you had your nose broken in The Longest Yard, and you were looking around afterwards, and when the guy apologized to you, that's the greatest scene of the movie.
That was all ad lib, and the director just loved it. He said, "Richard, he said, I love what you're doing. Do more of this ad libbing." He said, "You know, I didn't say cut and you stop." And he said, "I want you to go this time, but just keep going, you know, and don't worry about anything. Just, you know, I love it."
Well, that was the greatest scene in the movie. You're just sitting there, and you're like, you were just so happy that this guy apologized to you. And
yes, I didn't have to fight him because he was a pretty tough guy.
Well, that was the idea, and you were
exactly,
so big,
yeah.
And it's all these prisoners, and you're thrilled. He said he's sorry.
Well, I said he was sorry.
greatest scene. And our guest on the Big Show this evening, we have actor Richard Kiel. You know him from his James Bond movies. You know him from the Westerns. You know him from the big screen, but he's also a published author, and we're talking tonight about his book, Kentucky Lion, The True Story of Cassius Clay. And I guess, Richard, the first thing I want to ask you is, what's your connection to the South? Are you from the South? Because I don't hear an accent.
Well, when I was filming The Longest Yard, I met and married a young little girl from the South, and she didn't have a racist bone in her body, and that kind of surprised me because I'd, you know, seen the miniseries Roots, and they portrayed, you know, all the people in the South as kind of, you know, racist tyrants. And, of course, in the miniseries, they beat the slaves with whips, and they raped the black slave women. But, you know, what I found was that not all the people, you know, in the South are like that. And as I was doing research on the book, I discovered that only 4% of the people in the South actually owned slaves.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. And when you bring that comment up to people, a lot of people would go, oh, wait a minute. No, but to own slaves, you had to be rich. Poor people didn't own slaves. It's like today. I mean, you know, I don't own 20 cars if I don't have the money. They were a commodity back then. And it wasn't just like everybody had their own personal slave running around.
No, you had to be rich. And 96% of the people did not own slaves. And in fact, they were very, very adversely affected financially, because they had to compete with this almost free labor. And so, you know, if you were a gardener or a cook or a house painter or whatever, and you were a white working person, you couldn't make any money if you lived in the South. And hence the expression, poor white trash.
So what brought you to the story of Cassius Clay in particular?
Well, you know, it was about that time. My wife came with me from the South, and like I said, she wasn't a racist, nor were her family or her friends. And then I happened across this story of Cassius Clay. And I think we need to, you know, to tell your listeners that we're not talking about the black boxer who changed his name to Muhammad Ali.
Right, right. We're not talking about Muhammad Ali. We're talking about a white,
he was a plantation owner. When he inherited his father's plantation, his father was one of the richest men in Kentucky. He freed all of the slaves because growing up, his best friends were slaves. And he had a friend named George that he taught how to wrestle and fish. Well, they fished and hunted and wrestled together, and he taught him how to play chess. And, you know, he really realized that the slaves were going to need to be educated. And he also gave money and land to a Reverend John Fee to build a school for his freed slaves, so they could be taught, you know, how to read and write.
Now, it's a real interesting story, and I think it's a very little-known story. Did you find, or your time down South and when researching for the book, do you think people in the South know this story, or is this pretty much kind of a more hidden story of the South?
Yeah, he's kind of a forgotten hero. There are some people that do know about him in the South, and some, you know, scholars and historians that do. But, you know, I would say probably 99% of the general public know nothing about him. And, you know, he ran for president at the same time as Abraham Lincoln. And he threw his support to Lincoln and helped him become elected, gave him financial support. He graduated from Yale with a degree in law, but instead of becoming a lawyer, he became a legislator and used the family money to buy presses and publish a newspaper called The True American, which was the first anti-slavery newspaper in the South. And he was printing this anti-slavery newspaper 30 miles away from the slave auctions. So he kind of rocked the boat. They put a hitman on him, you know, the rich plantation owners, the 4%.
Well, I was just going to ask you, what did this do to his life? Because, I mean, there were the people who owned the slaves, you know, they didn't want this change. They didn't want any difference because that's how they made their money. That was their livelihood.
Well, you know, no way. But what he was able to do was to appeal to the 96% who were suffering financially because of slavery, the white working class, and get them to realize that they were the majority. You know, they were the 96% silent majority. And he got them to put pressure on their congressmen and state senators to pass a law putting a moratorium on slavery in Kentucky, which was the headquarters of slavery in America. So, you know, he really did rock the boat. And they tried to, you know, shoot him, assassinate him. They poisoned his son. And it's a really interesting story, courtroom drama, romance, affairs, everything.
Well, it's kind of, it's like you were saying, you know, it's a little known story that's historical, and it's all there. What made you, when it comes, you know, you've been an actor, and everybody knows you. I mean, I'm sure there's not a street you can't walk down and somebody's like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What made you decide to go, you know what, I'm writing a book. This is what I'm doing.
Well, you know, from an actor's viewpoint, this was the most dramatic story I'd ever heard. And, you know, I had this 6'3", 230-pound superhero that, you know, he does all kinds of things. You know, I won't go into all of them now, but, I mean, he was like a hero in the war against Mexico. he was a hero to his men, and you know, the guy was just like super macho. He allegedly fought some 200 duels in his lifetime, so he wasn't a guy to mess around with. But yet he was a poet and a romantic, and there's a lot of romance in the book, and it's a fun read.
Now, you know, when I had gotten this, when I first found out about your book, you know, I was pretty, you know, I was trying to figure out with the Southern connection, with the ongoing connection, what's the connection, or at least explain to my audience the connection that Cassius Clay, because of course, when you hear the name Cassius Clay, you all think of, oh, boxer, Muhammad Ali, we know who you're talking about.
Yeah, sure.
Where's
the
connection?
Okay, well, Muhammad Ali's father was originally named Cassius Clay, and Cassius Clay probably did more than any other American, perhaps besides Abraham Lincoln, to put an end to slavery in America. He not only, you know, freed his own slaves some 30 years before the Civil War and the Emancipation and started paying them wages, he helped to free literally hundreds of thousands of other slaves and to see that they got an education. Some 965 new elementary schools were built in the South in the 1860s by the party of Lincoln that Clay supported. And they built four new colleges, Hampton, Fisk, Atlanta, and the famous Howard University in the 1860s. So, you know, what amazed me was there was a lot of positive things done that we never hear about. And, you know, all we hear is the bad things. And, you know, we remember the things in Roots that, you know, were dramatic and bad. Well, to me, these are dramatic things too, but they're good and positive.
Well, and it's so easy to stereotype from the one side. I mean, because a lot of people, and I'll say myself included, I mean, I have cousins who live in North Carolina, another one lives in Tennessee, and I'll be the first to be like, oh, Southerners, you know, and it's easy to do, but there's so much of that history of the South we really don't know.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's important for people to be able to come out from under a cloud of guilt because they're Southerners, thinking that, you know, everybody owns slaves and, you know, I'm part of that, and realize that no, and, you know, it was just a bad thing that was happening because of money, and they were, you know, being exploited too and having to, you know, work for almost nothing. And so, you know, there was some animosity and all, but the thing is that we have to grow past that, and we have to have knowledge to do that.
Our guest is Richard Keel, The True Story of Cassius Clay. Kentucky Lion is his book. It's out now. You can find out more at claybook.com if you want to get more on the book. So, you know, Richard.
Yeah, that's www.claybook.com. And your listeners will get a free 8x10 autograph color photo signed by me from James Bond.
Man, I didn't even get one of those. Man, my listeners always make out better than
I. Well, you know what? I think your producer got it because we did send one.
I know. He probably took it.
Yeah, we sent one from the Happy Gilmore and The Longest Yard as well.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you because, you know, you've got Happy Gilmore, you're writing, you know, you talked about your wife, your kids. You know, what else are you doing? When am I going to look at you on the big screen again?
Well, you know,
I know there's a whole
consultant for the movie or miniseries, Kentucky Lion. You know, this is kind of like Schindler's List. He was to the South what Schindler was to Germany and the Jews. He was to the South and the slaves. By the way, my son is going to Drexel.
Oh, really?
The King of Prussia rang a bell that you're in the Philadelphia area.
Yeah, your son's going to Drexel.
Yeah, he's in his last year, and he's going to be graduating in May.
And moving back into the house.
No, I hope not. I've still got one here.
So what is he studying?
He's going to be a doctor and a cardiologist.
Oh, my. Well, there you go. That's what you need to bank on. Make the other one a lawyer. You're okay.
Well, yeah, one of them is a CPA. So.
Oh, you've got them all covered.
Yeah.
See, I'm just pushing for sports stars with my kids, you know, just to cover my retirement. Now, you know, I'm throwing this at you, and you can tell me if you don't even care, but one of the big stories, and I don't even know why it's the biggest, but the big stories in news today is this writer's strike going on. I don't know if you heard about it, but apparently every writer in Hollywood's on strike. You know, you spent so long, such a long time in Hollywood. How volatile is that relationship between, you know, studios and heads down through the actors, then to the writers? How hard is that relationship?
Well, you know, sometimes the producers are also writers, and so they kind of break the code and go ahead and write, but not too much of that goes on. It's you know, you're kind of going to be looking at reruns for a long time if they do go on strike. I actually broke into the movies during the writers' strike of 1960. Really, you know, bad timing, but you know, I managed to do it. And when the strike ended, I got really, you know, blessed to get some good roles and get going.
Well, I guess you can cause some problems then if you're doing that. And they're like, hey, you need to be out or be on our side. Does it make it harder? Because I guess in the last strike in the 80s, a lot of scabs who wrote made it through. But, you know, a lot of times you get blacklisted for that.
Yeah, and that has, you know, happened. But, you know, it provides some opportunities for other people as well. So, you know, I want to tell you, speaking of writers, my co-writer on this book has written 29 novels, and she got an Academy Award for the movie Witness with Harrison Ford. She co-wrote that screenplay.
Oh, right.
Screenplay of the year.
Pamela Wallace.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, how did you get together with her?
Well, you know, she happens to live in the same area that I live, and I, you know, ran into her. We discussed the story. I'd already done two drafts of it, and so she was very willing to come in and give a woman's touch, because there's a lot of romance, and you know, I wanted, you know, I felt I could handle the macho part, the action,
yeah,
and all that kind of stuff, but I wanted to get a woman's touch on the romance.
Yeah, let's face it, we're guys. As much as we try and be romantic, it's never going to be the same.
Well, you know, women have a different view of what's romantic than what we do, you know.
What do you mean Monday Night Football is not romantic?
I was going to ask you whether that traffic lady is as attractive as she sounds.
Yes, she is. And that's...
I bet she is, yeah.
Yeah, well, what do you mean, honey? Monday Night Football is not romantic.
Yeah,
come on.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, Richard, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule and joining us. You got a great book here. You can find out more at claybook.com. Start with the 3 W's and work from there. Claybook.com. You'll get your free autographed picture with it. But check out the book, because it's an interesting piece of history, and it's a part of history that you're not really going to hear anywhere else. No one's going to sit here and tell you the story. And Richard gets through it all in his book. And then go out and get any movie that Richard's been in, and you'll enjoy it. Because I grew up as a James Bond fan.
I'll get you one of those photos, Robert.
And the
book is in novel form, kind of like a John Jakes novel, Irving Stone novel.
Now, my question, oh, by the way, Force 10 from Navarone, with Barbara Bach in that.
Yeah,
movie.
Barbara Bach.
Did you ever...
Barbara Shaw, Harrison Ford.
Yeah, everybody. All you guys were in there. Did Ringo ever show up, and did you ever intimidate him?
No, you know, at that time, she wasn't with Ringo.
Right, so...
Yeah, in fact, she had a boyfriend that was an executive with United Artists. And I did three movies with Barbara Bach. I did another movie in Rome, in Italy, called The Humanoid. And, you know, every time that she'd be getting on an airplane to go make a movie, you know, Jaws would be getting on. And I think her boyfriend at that time was getting a little suspicious.
Yeah, well, you know, there
yeah,
you...
But then she made a movie called Caveman.
Yeah, Caveman with Ringo Starr.
Not a really great movie, but
no.
She did meet Ringo, and they really hit it off.
Yeah, her, John Matusak was in that. I remember that movie, too.
Yeah, and I almost was in that movie, which was...
Well, but, you guys could have just had parallel careers together.
Yeah, I think what happened was they would be looking at me to play a role, or looking at her, and then, you know, looking at her, they would see me, or vice versa, and we both ended up in a movie together.
Well, you know, it's great stuff, and I'll tell you what, I've enjoyed you in every movie I've seen. I swear, I've enjoyed you. You get such really cool roles that you get to play in. And maybe it's, you know, skill, but I think you've been lucky that way, that you just get to...
Well, you know, my dad used to say, the harder I work, the luckier I get. And what I did was, when I would have a good role, I'd run like a full-page ad in the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, and point out to people, hey, I can do that, you know. And so that helped me to be able to get more, you know, good roles. So you have to work at it. You have to invest in your career.
Well, that's why I tell my wife we don't invest in my career enough.
There you go.
But I'll tell you what, it's been great talking to you. You've got a fabulous book, and you can find out more. It's claybook.com, our guest this evening, Richard Keir. And Richard, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and joining us on the Big Show.
Robert, I'm serious. I'll send you that autographed photo. And everybody that goes on claybook.com that gets the book will get one of those too.
There you go. And if you speak to Barbara Bach again, I'll take a couple pictures of her.
Well, yeah, I wish I could.
Don't tell my wife.
You know, I haven't seen her since Ringo Starr came around.
He who hesitates, my friend.
There you go.
Well, you have a great night, and thanks for joining us tonight on The Big Show.
Thank you, Robert.
You're listening to The Big Show at Podomatic.com. I'm your host, Robert Henson. I want to thank you for being here. Now, in the beginning, before the interview with Richard Keir, I told you that this was going to be a two-parter. And so, who's in the second part? We have television legend Ed McMahon joining us, best known on television as the sidekick to Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Ed has a book out talking about television's early years and the early days of TV, not only the parts he's played, but roles from many other famous people he interviewed to help him write this book. And Ed took about 10, 11 minutes out of his day to join us on The Big Show.
What is Mr. McMahon? Call me Ed.
You know, I was raised in Catholic school.
And by the way, everybody sit down. It's embarrassing.
Well, I was standing. Thank you, Ed. I'm glad I can sit now.
I went to Catholic school. I'm not sure if I can call you, Ed, but I think we'll work through it.
Can I call you Robert?
You can call me anything you want to, really, at this point. Ed, I want to thank you for joining us. It's out now. When television was young, I guess my first question for you is, what made you decide at this point in your life to go back and kind of take a look at the career of television and all the influences that have been in it?
Well, the easy answer is that the editor that I work with on a book I did a couple of years ago called Here's Johnny, after Johnny left us, I wrote a book about Here's Johnny. Not Here's Johnny, but people kept asking me, what is he like? You know, and I said, well, the book said, Here's Johnny. You know, you want to know about him? Here he is. Anyway, that became a bestseller. So the author, not the author, but the editor on that book came to me and said, would you do a book about the beginning of television? And I said, I guess so. He said, well, you were there. I said, well, I was there, certainly. I started in Philadelphia on September 12th on WCIU. It used to be owned by CBS, Channel 10, for a three-hour daily variety show, September 12th, 1949. So do you think I've been there?
Well, we've changed a little bit, but yeah, you've been here now. Now, you decided to go back and look, and your book isn't only from what you've known, but it's also what the stars have done. Let's talk about some of the stars that really, I mean, impressed you over time.
Well, how about when I came back from the Korean War? I was called back to the Korean War. I'd been a Marine fighter pilot in World War II.
And also a trainer, weren't you?
I was an instructor and a test pilot and taught carrier landings, little things like that. But anyway, when the war finished, I went to Catholic University in Washington. Then I came up to apply for a job at WCIU the spring of 1949. I got hired for a job that I would start in September, which gave me a chance to work on the boardwalk for that summer and make a little scratch, because when you started in television in those days, they weren't very, what they say, they were very not, they weren't very generous with the funding. And, I'm telling you, I hosted a three-hour daily live variety show from 12 to 3. I was the host. I had a co-host. I had a girl singer. I had, somebody who played the piano. I had, if a circus came to town, I'd have two elephants on talking. Whatever it was, I did. So, you know, it's one of those things you say to yourself, what do you go back to? Well, what I went back to from the Korean War, after I had gone off to service for a year and a half, guess who my next-door neighbor was? A chap you may have heard of called Dick Clark.
Get out.
That's the truth.
So you're living next to Dick Clark.
We were next door to each other. My daughter was then 13, and I heard her tell one of her girlfriends on the phone, just imagine my bedroom wall is right next to Dick Clark's bedroom wall. She used to babysit his kids. Anyway, that's where I start. You know, I start with a test pattern, but I talk about Dick Clark. I talk about a lot of the people I work with over the years, Jerry Lewis and so forth. But it's just kind of, I'll tell you what it is. It explains to people that don't understand that there was a time when there was no television. I know that's hard to believe. I know you young folks can't believe it, but, you know, some of you used to sit on your father's knee or your grandfather's knee, and, you know, you'd look at the test pattern, and you say, oh, goody, look at this, something on the box. But that's where it goes back to. It starts with the invention of the whole idea of sending pictures through the air.
Well, you know, I am young enough to remember when TV used to turn off at night with the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, right. Yeah. He goes that far
back. That far back. And, you know, we only had three channels, four on a good day. Did you think, you know, even from your early days and then even, you know, when you were on, you know, Who Do You Trust, did you think your career would last this long? I mean, how much was the fluctuation of TV back then as compared to what you've seen through your career? Because some people are here and gone.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I mentioned in the book, and it's so true, everything we do now, we did then. In other words, that song, that great Broadway show tune, you know, Everything Old Is New Again, everything we did back then. I mean, we had quiz shows back then. We had dance shows back then. Everything was popular. We had dramas back then. We had everything. I was lucky to be in Philadelphia because, as you know, it's a tryout city for Broadway. So any show that was coming through Philadelphia on its way to Broadway, I could get access to all those top stars. So I was doing what was become, you know, a daytime talk show way back in 1949. Now, Arthur Godfrey had a thing called the Dance Party. Not Arthur Godfrey, Arthur Murray. Arthur Murray had the Arthur Murray Dance Party, and guess who won the Jitterbug Contest?
Who?
A guy named Johnny Carson.
Wow.
So when you tie all these things together and you, you know, put them together in a book, all of a sudden you've got something. And I'm very proud of this book. I think we've got something, but you know, what you find out when you read it is 50 years ago, they were doing the same things they're doing now, except we were flying blind, flying by the seat of our pants because no one knew how to do it.
You guys were making it all up.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, Ed, this is JT. I'm sitting in the studio with Robert. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Humongous fan, even bigger than me, Ed.
I have a picture of Johnny, actually, in my office that I rub every morning before I start my show to see if
that's a good move.
Some will rub off on me.
Actually. It's not working, by the way.
It's not. Not yet, at least. Now, I've read Here's Johnny, and I've read different biographies of you. I want to ask you about something more about your personal career. I know how much time you spent on trains going back and forth, you know, to and from New York to Philadelphia. You spent a lot of your time in telephone booths, you know, plopping dimes in, trying to find, you know, going from audition to audition. Was there ever a point in your career when you were just starting out that you thought that you weren't going to make it and you were just really about to hang up the hat and say, that's it?
Yeah, there was one day, one particular day, I had lost about three or four auditions in a row.
Mm-hmm.
In New York. This is in New York. I used to go up on the 8 o'clock train with the, you know, the rag merchants.
Right.
All the guys were in the garment business, and they'd all get on the first train. So would I, because no one would, you know, bother me. I'd be able to work. I'd read three newspapers on the way to New York. I'd do my notes, who I was going to call. I had my little wrapper of dimes, and I would, the first phone booth was my office. I'd just check in there as soon as I get to Penn Station in New York. And I'd check into a first, you know, phone booth and start making my calls. Anyway, there was one day when I lost about four auditions in a row. And I sat on the steps of the fountain outside the Plaza Hotel. And I said, I wonder if I should stay in this business or should I become an architect? That was my other desire. If I couldn't make it in this business, I wanted to be an architect.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving you a long answer to your question.
No, please, take as long as you want.
There was an architectural school somewhere near where I was, and I found out about it, and I walked down, and I inquired, you know, what I'd have to do and so forth. I'd already graduated from college, and I'd been to, like, three colleges now. At Boston College, I graduated from Catholic U in Washington. Anyway, I said, now, how much more he's trying to explain it to me, you know. I walked out the door. I said, I'm going to stick with television.
Are you? I'm assuming you're happy that you did that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Ed, I know you got to run. I know you got people coming over. By the way, expect JT and I at around 6 or 7 hours. We'll be over. But before I let you go, I want to ask, you know, you have one of the most recognizable names and faces in television history. That's just the way it is. How do you, and I'm not even sure, this may be the dumbest question anybody has ever asked you, but how do you, even today, still kind of get up with that, knowing that you have that mantra, that mantle, this, even if you want to consider it a burden, of being one of the most recognizable names and faces ever in TV history?
Let me tell you something, and I've got time to do this. I don't know when your next break is, but let me tell you.
I take no breaks for Ed McMahon.
Okay. I know what the clock is. Anyway, I was just with you guys, in a sense. I was just in Media, Pennsylvania, on Monday. I was the Grand Marshal of their Veterans Parade. It was on Monday, a small-town kind of atmosphere,
And
it was just wonderful. I mean, little kids were sitting on the curb. Kids were coming up to me asking my autograph, who had no idea who I was. But I was in a small town celebrating the Veterans Day because I wanted to go and help them with something they're doing for the Korean War. Anyway, I was there, and that's how close I was. But there I was being honored. I was the Grand Marshal. They had a whole bunch of kids sing the Marine Corps hymn to me, being an old Marine. And it was just a beautiful thing. Now, how do I handle it? I just get up and do it. I mean, I don't think it's anything special. I consider this my work, my hobby, my life's endeavor, and I just do what I have to do.
Do you still get butterflies?
Not really. If I do something really new, like when I worked the Vegas stage a couple of years ago, walking out on the Vegas stage was kind of, a little intimidating. Here I am on the Vegas stage. What am I doing here? When I get into something that's really big, like I played Broadway for a couple of weeks, replaced Alan King in a play. That was a big moment for me, being on Broadway. So you do still get, butterflies, and you guys do it. You just use that energy, the butterfly energy, to make your performance better. But
I ball up into a little ball and cry when I have...
You know, it's amazing to me that you say, though, that, it was a big thing for you, being on Broadway. It was a big thing because you would think that there's no big things left for Ed McMahon when it comes to entertainment.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, but thank you.
You've entertained everybody.
You really have.
That's my plan.
I used to get in trouble staying up too late at night watching Carson. So you've done it all. I know you've got people coming. You probably got your people in the background yelling at you.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for giving us time on the big show.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you. And, keep up doing the good work you're doing. So, on the big show. That's the name of your show. I like that, the big show.
And well, actually, one of the reasons I named it is because the Tonight Show was always the Tonight Show.
Oh, that's right. We already took that. I know that.
But it had a name. It didn't really, it had a name, and I always liked that. And next time you're in media, you stay at my house.
Okay, you got it.
Thank you very much,
okay,
Ed.
Thanks, guys.
Ed.
I appreciate it.